At the time, he did not believe strongly in Mia's story, nor did he have time to drive and walk with Mia through the Swiss countryside late at night. He had been curious but not curious enough. When Mia had first brought his exposed film to Bar, the shop owner had studied the photographs closely with a magnifying glass. He was certain he would be able to recognize a double exposure because the portion exposed twice always appears stronger. But he never saw any evidence that Mia had tinkered with the photographs. Bar said, "My personal opinion was always, I don't know about UFOs, but the pictures are real. You could drag me before a court of law and I would say the same thing I have told you." During the interview, Bar said he had always sold Mia equipment he could handle with one hand. That was the major selling point. Mia would come into the store and experiment for hours with every model until he found one that would be the easiest for him to use. Bar had once sold Mia an old 8mm camera made by Alcom that had been sitting around his shop for years. Nobody wanted to buy it, but it was by far the easiest movie camera to use with one hand. If he had an accomplice, Bar pointed out, he would not have to try out all the models to see what could be used with one hand. Beatrice Bar also knew Mia and often had spoken with him in the shop. Unknown to Mia, she, too, had studied his photos. "I don't believe in the same thing he does," she said. "But I always wondered just how he could do that because the pictures looked real, they didn't look faked. As a rule, if you have a double exposure or any reproduction, you can see the outline, but with his pictures, you could see nothing." She and her husband often had talked about Mia, but neither understood how the man could create such authentic-looking photography. Beatrice herself had decided that Mia fabricated everything, but she couldn't see how he was doing it. Nor could she understand, with so many people traveling to the farm to visit Mia, and now so many actually living with the mice, how some of them could not know or even be involved in the hoax. She wondered how Mia could keep all of them quiet, especially the children. "Children always talk," she said. Both Willie and Beatrice Barr had learned nearly everything they knew about photography and developing from a younger man who, several years before, had been employed at the shop when it had a different owner and who had encouraged the Bars to buy the shop when it came up for sale in 1970. Fritz Kindleman, who recently turned 31, had now worked there for 10 years. He knew Mia better than anyone in the store, had handled and inspected hundreds of his photographs, and often had talked with him since Mia began bringing his film to Bar for processing in 1973. Kindleman had been taking pictures since he was a small boy. When he turned 16 and, under the Swiss educational system, had to select a profession for study and apprenticeship, he chose video and television. Whenever new equipment came out on the market, he bought it so he could study how it worked. He now owned and could dismantle and reassemble many cameras, video, and 35mm. Quiet, somewhat disheveled, with hair sticking up in the back, and appearing almost lost when out of the lab or not behind a camera, Kindleman met one morning with Elders and Welch in a small pastry shop a few doors down from Bar Photo. At first, the conversation was of congenial things: Kindleman's interest in cameras, his years of experience at the bar shop. Then, speaking through an interpreter, Elders asked Kindleman, "Did Mr. Mia ever ask you about darkroom techniques or film developing?" Kindleman shook his head. "Never," said Elders. Kindleman turned to the interpreter and said that Mia never asked any questions about such things. "Of course, I must admit," he added, "in the beginning, I was very critical when he came in with these pictures. But he kept bringing them in. Today, I am convinced this is the real thing." The photographer seemed equally positive that Mia had no color photo lab of his own hidden away somewhere. The processing and equipment were far too expensive and complex to be owned and operated by a single individual. Bar Photo itself had no such sophisticated laboratory. Every roll of film Mia brought to the shop, and often there were as many as 4 or 5 a week, Bar sent to one of three places: Slides to Lowe's and Kodak, Ektachrome to Studio 13 in Zurich, prints to Weidenswil Labor Pro Sign. Since Mia used both print and slide film, his negatives had to be sent to all three Swiss laboratories. Kindleman's job included scanning random pictures when they came back from the developing labs, checking through the packets to ensure the quality of the photos and slides they returned to their customers. He had examined many of Mia's photographs before Mia himself had seen them. And he was certain there had never been any of what he called manipulation of the photos. Welch asked him why. Warren? On the table in front of them lay a picture of Mia's they had brought to the interview, two beamships close up, one below the crest of a hill and one just above. Kindleman picked it up and immediately began to talk. If you wanted to superimpose those two UFOs on the landscape, you would have to practice for a long time to get the upper one without any shadows on it. You must understand when you bring in a whole strip of film there are many pictures on that strip. If this shot had been manipulated, you would assume that on that strip of film you would have several shots of the same scene but of different quality because he's experimenting with that scene. Now if Herr Mia had come into the store just to order one picture and, on the strip to the left and to the right there were the same scene with different lighting techniques, then I would have immediately noticed these pictures had been manipulated. But I never had the slightest suspicion the pictures had been manipulated. I exclude such a possibility. Whenever he brought in negatives to have prints made, the negatives were always in strips, not cut up. Welch asked Kindleman if there was any way Mia could have manipulated some of these pictures without his being able to detect it. Kindleman became indignant. I can't imagine that, he said. Absolutely not. Kindleman also said they had told Mia again and again to take better care of his negatives because he would bring them in scratched and smudged. Elders and Welch had surmised that when they got to Bar Photo, they would discover that Mia frequently had been in, asking about darkroom techniques. But according to the man in the shop who had spent the greatest amount of time with him, he never asked such questions. Kindleman told them that most of Mia's film was in slides and that if Mia had wanted to fake pictures of that size, he would have needed specialized macro equipment, but Mia didn't have any. Had he ever asked me questions about macro technique or how to light macro shots, then I would have become suspicious, said Kindleman. Had he asked me pointed questions, I might have studied those photos more carefully, but he never gave me reason to disbelieve him. Perhaps the single thing that impressed Kindleman was Mia's 8mm films of the beamships, Mia's footage of the beamship that appears to cut in front of a tall pine causing it to sway, of the ship coming to a stop over Hastenbowl, and of the craft that begins to dematerialize above a hillside and seems to be reappearing down below in the same frame. Video and movie film had become Kindleman's specialty. He told Elders and Welch, when I saw these shots they looked real to me. Even on warm summer evenings, the large Mia kitchen with its many chairs continued to be the place for everyone to gather. After a dinner of boiled potatoes from the garden, with perhaps some cheese and a loaf of bread out of the oven, most everyone simply remained at the table, especially if there were guests. Chairs got rearranged, people tilted back or leaned on the table, and the conversation went on until the evening light showing through the kitchen windows first had softened to grey, and then finally turned black. We had many such evenings, recalled Welch. On one that I'll always remember, we talked about the Pleiadians, what Mia had been told, their knowledge of their past, tracing it from Lyra, how they for the first time came in contact with Earth. I think we sat there spellbound for about 2 hours. And the way it came out of him was more than interesting. He found it interesting, and so he would highlight points that were interesting to him or somehow had surprised him, as a couple of things had. I looked at all of it in a dual sense, the question whether it was too far out to believe, I felt we'd find the answer to later so that wasn't important to me. At that time, I was more interested in experiencing, watching, and hearing all of it, and I enjoyed the experience. And what was impressing me to no end was that a lot of what was coming out of Mia was not Mia. It was alien to the man and to his style of describing things. He was explaining something he'd been told by somebody else. Whoever was the source of all this description was very, very intelligent, very, very good at communicating a fact or an event. And very philosophical at times in an alien way or highly, technically accurate in a way that Mia didn't even seem to be aware of. "We are the Pleiadians," Mia was explaining to the people at the table. "We came from a cross between the Pleiadians and the human beings from the Earth. Why don't we live as long as they do?" asked Welch. "We have to build up our age," said Mia, "like they had to do on their planets some millions or billion years ago. The age of a living form, especially of a human being, will evolve very slowly, like his wisdom and knowledge, and his technology. You can see here in Europe, some 25 years ago, we had an average age for the European people of 72 years. And now, it's up to 75 years. What does Era look like?" asked Elders. Mia said he had never traveled there. "But it looks nearly like Earth," he explained. "It's a little bit smaller than Earth, and the buildings there are round. The vehicles have no wheels, they hover, and the work is done by robots and androids. The androids are half mechanical and half organic, and they are able to think by themselves, but humans oversee everything that's done. Each family is not more than 5 persons, the parents and a maximum of 3 children." Mia told them that about 3,000 ships from other star systems in the galaxy visit the Earth each year. "There's 8 different human races that have stations here on Earth," he claimed. "They are here exploring, they are here studying, they are here watching." "Are any of them here to try to destroy us?" asked Elders. "No," said Mia. "If a human race can cross a very, very great distance, maybe light years of space, they will not be coming here to make trouble or start a war. The Earth human is a fighting creature, his whole life is based on fighting, so he thinks if there is a human race on another planet, those creatures will be exactly the same as he is. But that isn't true. If they so desired, the Pleiadians could destroy the Earth in a matter of minutes," said Mia. "They could have enslaved all Earthlings thousands of years ago." Mia admitted that some of the other ships had picked up humans against their will, but he compared the situation to Earth scientists and anthropologists who, upon discovering a primitive people still on Earth, dispatch teams to study them and return them to the lab. "Humans are humans," said Mia. "If the Pleiadians or other entities abducted Earth humans, it served only to satisfy their legitimate curiosity. Occasionally, a mistake might be made, and an abducted human would die, much as Earth doctors made mistakes causing people to die. But human life was never taken purposely. Mia was certain that World War III would take place. "That will be for sure," he said. "When will it happen?" asked Welch. "That's a good question," said Mia. "Very soon?" "It's not so far," replied Mia. "They know the exact dates, but it's not so good to know them." "Won't the Pleiadians try to stop it?" asked Welch. "It is impossible," said Mia. He told the people at the table that the Pleiadians are not allowed to interfere with the development of Earth. "It is absolutely impossible to stop all these things. Some 2,000 years ago, World War III was called by several prophets. Nobody heard them for 2,000 years. And now it's really too late. Such a holocaust could be prevented only by change, and change could be effected in only 2 ways. One was by teaching, by showing Earth humans how to advance spiritually from within, which the Pleiadians desired to do. The other was to use force, which the Pleiadians forbid. They would not step in to prevent war unless our Earth war threatened civilizations elsewhere. Though they possess the power to stop the ultimate conflagration, they would stand idly by and watch us destroy ourselves if we chose to do so, even if a crazy man reached for the button. The Pleiadians attempted only to effect small changes in people of clear head and heart, by teaching and allowing the person to grow from the inside. "If you travel into space," said Mia, "you will find humans wherever you go. And when they start to think, they need a teacher. If they have never seen a flower before, never heard anything about a flower, the one who knows the flower can teach them. And this is the way over the whole universe. The photographs are only to make people think, to show them something. People shall come for these pictures, but they shall study the teachings, and they shall come to know. Amir told Welch of many things that had been explained to him by the Pleiadians, one of the most intriguing and controversial being perhaps the most fundamental to the Pleiadian presence on Earth. With the Pleiades nearly 500 light-years from Earth, conventional Earth physics dictated that traveling at the greatest speed conceivable, the speed of light, a trip from the Pleiades to Earth and back again would require 1,000 years. Yet, Mir maintained that the Pleiadian propulsion system was capable of speeds many millions of times faster than light and that some Jays frequently traveled back and forth between her home planet Hera and Earth. The Pleiadians, said Mir, made the trip in 7 hours. During the fourth contact and again in the eighth, some Jays had explained to Mir aspects of the propulsion system that enabled the Pleiadian beamships to transcend distance and the passage of time. For traveling through cosmic space, she said, a drive is necessary which surpasses the speed of light many times over. But this propulsion can come into action only when the speed of light is already attained. This means, then, that a beamship needs at least two drives, a normal drive which provides acceleration up to the speed of light and a second hyperdrive, as you would call it. With this, we are able to paralyze time and space simultaneously, explained Semjays. They collapse into null time and null space. And only when time and space have ceased to exist are we capable of traveling through distances of light years in a tiny particle of a second. This is done so quickly that living forms are not aware of it. The reason we need 7 hours to reach Earth is because first we must fly far into space before we can convert to hyperspeed. We then come back out of the hyperspace condition far outside of your solar system and fly to here once more in normal drive. I am not allowed to give you any further details. But I can tell you that your advanced scientific circles are already working on systems known as light-emitting drives and tachyon drives. The elemental principles are already known to them. The light-emitting drive serves as the normal propulsion system to move the ships to the limits of space and time. Once the tachyon drive is brought into action. This is the hyperpropulsion system, which is able to force space and time into hyperspace. We use other names, but the principles are exactly the same. Before Stevens's first trip to Switzerland in 1977, Luzenstag had sent him the contact notes pertaining to the Pleiadian propulsion system. But Stevens had never heard the term tachyon. Nor had the elders or Welch. After Welch had read in the contact notes Semjays's explanation of Pleiadian propulsion to Mir, he questioned the man often about the concept. Welch came away thinking that Mir knew more than he should, both for his station in life and for the dearth of information on the subject in all but the most sophisticated scientific circles. He wrote down in the notes what he had been told, said Welch, and then he elaborated on what he understood of the concept as a method of space travel. I saw those notes in 78. We did learn later that, for some period of time, specialists either connected with NASA or with companies like General Dynamics had been quietly working on that as a propulsion concept. What's interesting is that the man who wrote the notes has a formal education equivalent to the 5th or 6th grade. He does not live near major libraries, he does not live near major scientific centers. He doesn't have immediate contacts in those fields. At the time, we didn't know what tachyon meant. Most physicists didn't know what a tachyon was. And to apply the concept of theoretical tachyon to space propulsion is a huge step to make. There was no evidence that we could dig up that he had collaborated with anybody on this. But the thing that was startling to me was that, as soon as we started to dig into that, all of a sudden something else would pop up. In the notes or through Billy, that was equally sophisticated, unique, and advanced in a different field. In the notes, there were conversations about the universe and celestial mechanics, about healing methods and advanced medical equipment that just did not make sense coming from a man out in the remote countryside of Switzerland. Most of it, though, I noticed in the way he carried himself in conversations, the way he dealt with knowledge. It all seemed out of context with his personality. It seemed as if the man had a tutor in various fields who was one incredible tutor. After my first trip in the summer of 78, said Welch. We got together and decided there was a tremendous amount of information here, a tremendous number of unanswered questions. We were intrigued, we were hooked at this point. Witnesses we had met seemed quite sincere, as well as changed. That was the thing. They seemed changed. There was a sense of change in the area all around the Mir farmhouse, something that you couldn't put your finger on, just something you sensed. I can give you an analogy. Some of the people we met reflected the same kind of change you would detect in someone who's been on an operating table and has been termed technically dead for 2 or 3 minutes and then comes back. I had talked to 2 people like that, so I knew the difference. They have a light airiness about them, a sense of harmony about their lives that envelops you when you talk to them. I sensed that in some of the witnesses. When I left after that trip, I had the feeling, I don't know what it is, but something is going on. Something here is going on. And I wouldn't have been satisfied if Mio himself all of a sudden had stood up in front of everybody and shocked them by saying, I faked everything. I wouldn't have believed that because he couldn't have known how. Nina, although little known in the United States before 1979, the case of Edouard Mier would emerge as one of the most controversial in the history of UFO phenomena. No case had ever offered so much evidence. In fact, Mier seemed to possess more evidence than nearly all previous UFO cases combined. But that evidence would be seen by few and studied by even fewer, because Mia's preposterous and sometimes misunderstood stories of traveling back in time to see Jesus and photographing the eye of God would be laughed at and dismissed as nonsense, the same as Lee Elders had reacted before he had seen with his own eyes the conditions in which Mia lived, talked with the witnesses, and walked the sites. Mia's stories couldn't be true, but neither could the witnesses and the evidence be dismissed easily. Instead of space potatoes from the moon and piano music from Saturn, Mia offered scientists what they had asked for 32 years, something they could place under a microscope or enter into a computer and examine. And Lee Elders held all of it in his hands. But in the late 1970s in the United States, at least a dozen private groups vied for such evidence. The Aerial Phenomena Research Organization, APRO, headquartered in Tucson, and the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, in Sequin, Texas, were the largest now that NICAP was defunct. Both organizations boasted several scientists and experts in various fields who lent prestige to the group's activities and publications. But the research, the gathering of facts, the interviewing of the rancher who had observed the strange light in the night sky, often was conducted by volunteers whose only qualification was the dues they paid to be members of the organization. Hobbyists, Stevens called them. Often their investigations are no more than meeting the witness in his living room and discussing his experience over tea or coffee. Usually short-lived and poorly financed, most investigations generated 1 or 2 pieces of paper to be mailed to the organization's headquarters, which most often was the home of the director. Though united in a common cause, this small community churned with dissension. Because each organization remained viable only through the energy, juice, and contributions of its members, keeping their interest high was important, and this often led to intense competition for the more compelling stories. Should one group discover an intriguing case with claims or photographs to captivate its membership, it would often conceal such discovery as long as possible. Debate over old cases raged for years. Newsletters and bulletins mailed to memberships of a few hundred or a few thousand became forums for attacking not only cases, but other ufologists. Emotions ran high and accusations were sometimes vicious. When Stevens returned from Switzerland after meeting Edouard Mier in the fall of 1977, he felt the case was so big, complex, and potentially sensational that if he took it to one of these groups it would become embroiled in the politics of the UFO community. He wanted to avoid this. Stevens had his own critics. One prominent ufologist, Stanton Friedman, had labeled him a case collector, not investigator. Stevens also knew that most ufologists still automatically dismissed contact cases, especially claims of repeated contact. but he felt that the Mia case had hard evidence and that this evidence needed more than the typical short-term, poorly financed investigation by one of the UFO groups. Instead, he had approached the Elders and Welch, who were experienced in investigation and the preservation of evidence, and, most important, had no connection with any UFO organization. Immediately, Elders had capped the case with a tight lid of security. "I guess I was overly protective with this case in the beginning," he said later. "And rightfully so. I still wasn't totally convinced it was for real. But I'd be damned if I would let anybody get near the evidence. We're talking about hard evidence. I made a lot of enemies that way. Our problems really began right after that with the UFO community. In the summer of 1978, Jim Dilatoso set out to explore, experiment, and talk to people about how the mere evidence might be legitimately tested. If he was to organize the testing, he needed to know the latest equipment, the qualified scientists, and the proper procedures. He searched first for the experts. Then he spent a year writing and phoning them, sometimes interviewing them in person, before he understood what tests should be performed and what equipment should be used, and which scientists were not only knowledgeable, but also open-minded enough to analyze evidence associated with UFOs. After he felt he understood the procedures, he tried to locate and use the equipment at various labs and universities before he approached one of the scientists with the actual evidence in his hand. "At times I cringed about it," said Welch. "It would have been much nicer to have somebody with a PhD who'd spent 5 years in research at Harvard to be the carrying on that conversation for us. Also, I cringed many times because we couldn't be sitting there with 820,000 check in our hand when approaching someone to ask to use their equipment or to do the work." Once he understood what needed to be done, Dilatoso then had to convince the scientists themselves to perform the actual procedures on the metal, sound recording, and photographs, and that proved difficult. A scientist's reputation remains only as good as his credibility, and many, if not most, scientists felt their credibility would be seriously threatened if it were known they were studying UFOs. But after many tries, Dilatoso discovered an Achilles heel he suspected might exist: the natural curiosity of the scientist. B. Marcel Vogel was a research chemist, one of less than a dozen senior scientists at the IBM facility in San Jose that employed 9,000 people. The holder of 32 patents. He had worked for IBM for 22 years, inventing for the huge computer company the magnetic disk coating memory system still used in IBM disk memories throughout the world. Research begun in 1960 by Vogel also had introduced the use of liquid crystals for optical display. Now a specialist in the conversion of energy inside crystals, Vogel probed the interior of crystalline structures with the most complete optical microscopic equipment available in the world, a system of scanning electron microscopes costing $250,000. In his 40 years as a scientist, Vogel had received many unusual requests for his expertise, but the strangest came in mid-April 1979, in a phone call from Jim Dilatoso. Searching for scientists to examine the mere evidence, Dilatoso had discovered Vogel at IBM and felt he represented the perfect blend of expertise and curiosity. Eminent in his field, he had a reputation for being open to new ideas, even those on the fringe of science. When Dilatoso contacted Vogel, the scientist seemed amused with the story, but intrigued as well. Stevens followed with a letter cataloging the samples in his possession, various crystals that Mia had labeled as coming from certain planets in other star systems, and four states of metal used in forming the hull of the Palladian beamships. "These specimens are available for any kind of non-destructive analysis," wrote Stevens. Both men explained to Vogel that the samples had been entrusted to Stevens by a Swiss farmer named Eduard Mia, who claimed since 1975 to have met face to face over 100 times with beings from the star cluster known as the Pleiades. "I am personally convinced that the contact is actually taking place," wrote Stevens, "and is still to this date proceeding on an irregular basis." Skeptical but curious, Vogel agreed to conduct an analysis. Later he admitted, "I've had a rather negative feeling toward UFOs because, I said, unless I have something physical that I can get my hands on, just reported sightings and things like that have no interest to me." One Saturday morning, not long after he had agreed to examine the mere evidence, Vogel found lying on his doorstep a small padded mailer addressed to him.